I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Whatever image you may have of the ancient Ark of the Covenant, your imagination has likely been influenced by Steven Spielberg. Can you believe 4 decades have passed since the release of his Raiders movie? Well, the biblical account of this most sacred relic of the Israelites depicts a wooden chest covered in pure gold with an elaborate lid called the mercy seat, and inside, the 2 stone tablets of the 10 Commandments. I could add here that the New Testament book of Hebrews makes mention also of a pot of manna and Aaron's rod. Now, sometime between the writing of the biblical accounts and the writing of that Hollywood screenplay, some British adventurers went hunting for the Ark. None of them named Harrison. One of them was actually named Charles Warren and the other Monty Parker. Today on Constant Wonder, we're going to hear the truth stranger than fiction stories of these 2 determined gents and the associates they dragged into their very determined attempts to find this golden cask or box from ancient times, looking somewhere underground in the Jerusalem of the latter 19th and early 20th centuries. Our guest is scholar Brad Ricca. He's author of True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. He joins with us now. Brad, welcome.
Marcus, thanks so much for having me on.
Did you have to disabuse yourself of any of that Harrison Ford stuff? Did you have to put the Spielberg behind you to approach this topic?
You know, that's a great question, because when I started out, I said, somehow I have to do that, is get rid of all that stuff that I grew up on. Raiders is my all-time favorite movie. But I quickly realized that I just couldn't do it. And then I realized that anyone reading the book can't do it either if they've seen the movie. So I kind of leaned into it because it is about the Ark of the Covenant. So you can't really, it's hard to write about a book that no one, about something that no one's seen in 2000 years, if they've seen it at all. So I kind of leaned into the Raiders experience to make it as much of an adventure as I think it really was in real life.
Now, in part, I'm asking about the adventure, the nature of the adventure, being in that part of the world. I think of it as being arid and dusty and difficult terrain or a lot of stones everywhere that are in the way of everything you want to do. But I'm also asking just about the artifact itself, the relic, the legendary Ark of the Covenant, and maybe the Spielberg movie kind of depicts it, you know, as best as one ever could.
I mean, I think it does. When you look at kind of the early, there's all these early illustrations and engravings, and some of them, you know, if you go back to Raiders the movie, they show Indy, one of them, and it's been, you know, doctored and made up, but the Ark is on the hillside and striking down its enemies in this really dramatic way. But when you look at the Old Testament, which very clearly delineates what the Ark is made of and how to construct it and how to carry it around. The movie does a great job of drawing upon that and some of the early 20th century artists who started to, and 19th century painters who were really making up, you know, conceptions of the Ark. So it's something that, you know, we know of from the Old Testament, but that's really about it. So there's a lot of room for artistic license, but everyone kind of sticks to those facts in the Bible.
Now, when I contemplate the idea that we're going to talk about Captain Warren, this Charles Warren fellow, and then also a fellow named Monty Parker, I'm going to have to be careful not to say Monty Python. I just don't know. There's a temptation there with the P. I would imagine that their imagination of what they were looking for and my imagination of the Ark might be, there's kind of a convergence there because we're dealing with the very same old story.
Absolutely. And that's, I think you nailed it, because no matter what changes over the years, it's still going back to that, those verses of, you know, King David dancing in front of the Ark and striking, you know, they take it around Jericho, and all these old stories that get repeated and repeated and just lay claim to the imagination when we talk about the Ark. So I think they were definitely as full as of wonder as we might be about this story. But I think they even had more so, because nowadays when you hear from people, so I've been hearing from a lot of people, this book's about to come out, who are, you know, emailing me and saying, well, I found the Ark and I'm going to go get it, or I found it a couple of years ago.
No, you don't have people doing that. Do you really?
I absolutely do. And it's so awesome. And it's, you know, you're a little like, okay, sure you did. And there's not that level of that I think Warren and Parker had, that they hear this rumor that someone knows where the Ark is, or there's a secret code to get it, and they're out the door. They're ready to go because they, I think, you know, really believed that it was there.
Yeah. And that's the spirit in which you'd have to proceed. You couldn't not trust yourself on that, or else you wouldn't make the sacrifice involved. This was hard work for them to do.
Oh yeah. And it was really expensive too. And someone pointed out to me, they said, well, this is a real British thing to do too. If you hear this like hint or rumor of something abroad, you just go. and I think there's some truth to that. But yeah, I you know, it's not something that a lot of us do today, is just go, I'm going to go hunt for the Ark of the Covenant today, honey. yeah, there's a level of wonder and realism to it back then that I think we've lost, generally speaking, today.
Well, let's find out who these two people were, and their expeditions happened at a remove from each other in time. The same location, but years apart. Captain Charles Warren is the first one, and then Monty Parker the second. And Parker, who comes afterward, he leans on what Warren may have gleaned from his expedition, right?
Yeah. When I started the book, I was focused on Monty Parker, because he's the one who goes after the Ark itself. But the more I went through it, I found that he was using Warren's own discoveries from decades before, and it made sense to have two different narratives in there. I mean, it's primarily Parker's, but Warren does all this stuff early on, and he does it in the name of archaeology. He's sent to Palestine. He was sent by the PEF, the Palestine Exploration Fund, and he was charged to find a lot of things, and he started, I think, putting clues together and seeing that there was more here than anyone realized, and laying the groundwork. I mean, he was doing, you know, it's archaeology. It's an archaeologist today would say, well, you know, he cut a lot of corners and did a lot of things wrong. But this was at the forefront of the work in Palestine. And what he did, though, was open up this idea that there was a lot more here, which led the way to treasure hunters and raiders like Monty and others.
So when Captain Warren is there, this is not too long after some of those first European exploits into Egypt, you know, to raid whatever was there to be raided, whether it was a tomb or what have you. And so I understand that the methodology might have been, you know, kind of primitive compared to how the systematic archaeology is conducted today. But Warren was actually, he saw himself as a scientist.
Yeah, I mean, he was this one of, I really hate, you know, to kind of, all of a sudden I'm categorizing the British as doing all these sorts of things at once. But he was a man of many talents. I mean, he was a soldier. He goes on to do something later in the book, also in police work, which astounded me. But he, of course, he's also an archaeologist, because it's that time where you could be good at a lot of things, or at least convince other people that you were. but he really did kind of the good work. I mean, he the stuff he took out, he was, you know, adamant that it be in museums. He wanted good museums in London and England, where there weren't yet. But then, of course, like you said, it goes back to this whole argument that I think threads throughout the book, is it's great that these people are, you know, looking for stuff and digging around, but whose stuff is this, right? I mean, whose right is it to take it away or leave it there or what have you? But yeah, he really is an interesting person of many talents, like I said, whether you believe he's good at all of them or not.
So take us to Jerusalem with Captain Warren and tell us a little bit about his adventure. Does he scrape up his knees at all?
The book starts, I wanted to start because I knew people, you know, were coming from Raiders of the Lost Ark on this. So you have to start with a adventure piece, I think. So there's this great story that Warren writes about. He's also a prolific writer, which really helps me a lot, where he's going through a tunnel, you know, just outside of Jerusalem, and he's with his friend and a local guide, and all of a sudden the tunnel gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and the water starts to rise. So you have this point where, you know, you're far from home, just looking for the unknown underneath Jerusalem, and all of a sudden your life is in danger. And what does Warren do? Does he turn around? He goes forward. And it doesn't seem like they really do much at the time. And that's another reason I wanted to keep him in the story, is they just kind of push through this tunnel. But as you read on, you find that this tunnel becomes immensely important, not only for local and biblical history. They find certain things there, but also for the Parker expedition, which comes back years later and clears out the tunnel in search of the Ark this time.
So this tunnel, is this Hezekiah's tunnel? Is this that aqueduct?
Yes. Yes.
So it's intentionally built there in ancient times to channel water from a stream. And the way I understand the story is that this was all in anticipation of maybe a besieged city. You got to have water. And so you're trying to, you know, prepare for tough times, and you got to have water within the city.
Yeah. I mean, there's still... one of the great things about writing this book is I got to read a lot of the current archaeology on it. And this fact of what is Hezekiah's tunnel is still, you know, some people still debate it. They're not sure if it was built for this. But it's a man-made in parts tunnel with water that rises and falls. And if you go to Jerusalem today, you can actually walk through it, which I think is really cool. But there's all these stories in the Bible that they try to ascribe to Hezekiah's tunnel with King David, you know, raiding the neighboring tribes and taking over Jerusalem, and, you know, different kinds of peoples that lived there before the Israelites. So it takes on all these manner of stories that we find out later, and one of them includes that the Ark may be hidden there.
Now, back to Warren, and he's in the tunnel, and it's getting narrower, and the water is rising, and he says, I'm going to persevere, I'm going forward. What happens then?
Well, it's he goes forward, and the water gets taller, and the tunnel gets even smaller. It would look great on film, I think, but, you know, I just write the story. So, but he goes through, and there comes a point where he goes under to see what's there, and he under the water, and he sees kind of a shadowy tunnel that seems to go off to the side, and it doesn't mean much to him. But we return to the tunnel later when Parker arrives, and we find that this might be a very important tunnel that might go all the way to the Temple Mount itself, the legendary hiding place of the Ark of the Covenant. And Warren has his own. He fumbles and he chokes and almost swallows his beloved pencil. He has this pencil he really likes, and he almost drowns. But they eventually get out of the tunnel and they find that it connects with another side to a fountain, and he starts, you know, writing about it and drawing maps for it, not really knowing what he has, but we find that it becomes important later to the Ark expedition.
Now, apart from the tunnel itself being a bit of an antagonist in this story, were there other people that were getting in his way or that he had to persuade? I'm just thinking about the local population, the sensibilities people may have had about him poking around under the city. All of that, I mean, you don't just walk up to an ancient tunnel and say, I'm walking in, do you?
He had kind of a reputation that he worked out fairly quickly, where people knew he was the guy to go to if you found something old. And part of it was, I think he was being backed with money. And part of it, I think he was pretty persuasive. But he was among the first. So when you're the first, you can tend to get away with a lot more. By the time his kind of tour in Jerusalem ends, people are barring him from everything. He wants to dig under, right by the walls of Jerusalem, he wants to dig under a cemetery, an old Jewish cemetery. And they say, you know, there's no way. This is completely sacrilegious. He, of course, does it anyway. But so I think when you start out doing something, you can get away a little more. And then kind of after he leaves, more people come in once they see the kinds of things that he and others, you know, there's some French archaeologists there, you know, making these great finds worth a lot of money and just, you know, worth a lot to history, too.
I'm glad you described it as his tour of Jerusalem, because this isn't just like a weekend's escapade. This is a long stay, I would imagine.
Yeah, he's there for years, and he goes and comes back. He gets sick. He's sick half the time. But I shouldn't laugh, because he describes in detail that he sleeps in these, you know, wet kind of sleeping blankets and wakes up miserable, but then, you know, jumps in some tunnel with his workers. And at the end, he's doing like such reckless stuff that he can't even get people to work for him. He can't even pay them. So he's doing it himself. But he finds all this mystery. And it all kind of cycles back years later to what they find again, because I think that's kind of a lot of what I was trying to do with this story, is when they're all so interested in the historical Bible. And everyone was interested at that time in it. You know, what can we find in the Holy Land that shows it was all true, that shows that it's real? And he really started doing that on the ground, and just opened the door for all this other work.
So does he come to any kind of useful conclusions? I mean, to go in there with questions, to be looking for stuff, and you come away, hopefully, you know, there's a little bit more, you know, to talk about when you're done.
Yeah, I think he's kind of a harder one to pin down as to what he was looking for, both physically and, if any, kind of spiritually, which I think Monty Parker, I think, is a little easier to kind of tease that out. But Warren, I think, was just going there for stuff. And he was interested in the stuff to bring back and put in a museum. And he kind of liked the fact that his name would be on the stuff, and maybe a little more than the average archaeologist. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but he was also interested in meaning behind it. He was very interested. He finds strange symbols underneath the walls of Jerusalem. That turn out to be Phoenician. And he wonders, you know, how did they get down here? And he has all these just sort of riddles that he has to think about. And that goes on after he leaves. I think confronted with strange things that he can't all the way explain, he struggles with that. But I think he likes that. I think that's why he kind of goes through all these different careers. He's trying to find an answer to these mysteries.
Well, chapter two in this saga is the Monty Parker half of the story. And I guess that he might be a little bit more flamboyant in some ways than Captain Warren was. We are visiting with Brad Ricca about his book, True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. Time for a short break here on Constant Wonder. We'll return in just a moment. You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're visiting with Brad Ricca about his story, his account, titled True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. So if Monty Parker was following up on the heels of whatever it was that Captain Charles Warren was able to discover, Parker was motivated by kind of the same thing, maybe?
Yeah, I think Warren was, you know, looking for stuff, looking for biblical history and kind of confused by all these strange things he saw. But Monty is, I think, motivated by, for lack of better terms, fortune and glory. He knows that there's money if he finds the ark, riches beyond your wildest dreams, but also the real glory of it all. I think he's motivated in the beginning, because I think it does change as he's there, but he is motivated by practical concerns. But the interesting thing is, you know, Warren's going after kind of statues and obelisks and this kind of thing. And Monty Parker is told, well, the ark's there. And he says, okay, we're going to find the Ark of the Covenant. So it's the bar is raised, you know, way up into the stratosphere with him.
Who puts him up to it other than, I mean, he leans on some people and there are other parties who really want him to succeed. And he goes to, and talks with, I guess this, is it a Finnish scholar?
Yeah. So there's this consortium. They call themselves the Syndicate. And they're all these, as they always are, they're these middle-aged rich white guys. And they, some of them have some money and they hear about this project. And there's this Finnish scholar named Dr. Walter Juvelius. And he claims that he has found a cipher in the Old Testament, a code, where he can read off every seventh letter and loop around and move things forward, that gives him a secret message where the ark is. And finally, they all get together and he shows where this is, shows how he does it, shows it on a map. And it's really, really out there. Not something you might want to invest your money in, but at the same time, it's incredibly enticing and provocative because he shows these passages that he has decoded that say, you know, go 40 steps this way and turn left and you will see the glory of God. And so it's very enticing. So they start to raise money, they hire people, and they go and try and get it.
And how many years after the Warren expedition or research is this? We're talking a few decades?
Yeah, it's like 30 years. Thereabouts, give or take.
Yeah. And who is the person, some celebrity figure, a woman who's also involved in promoting this, I guess?
Yeah. So Ava Astor, who is this famous socialite married into the Astor family, and has this very famous divorce, very rich, known as the most beautiful woman in the world. That's what all the newspapers said. And she comes to London and kind of infiltrates London society. And she's linked with Monty at several, you know, in gossip columns and all this kind of pre-internet celebrity buzz, because Monty is kind of a noble family and it's a could be a match. And they wonder, is he going to marry Ava Astor?
I have to interrupt and just ask if he's suave and debonair, you know, because this has the makings of, you know, leading man in Hollywood.
So there's a lot of things with Monty I had to guess at, because I didn't have, like, he didn't keep a diary or this kind of thing. But the answer to that is an unqualified yes, because he kept showing up in the gossip columns, you know, as doing those sorts of things. And even I have a picture of him when he was in his 60s at some ball next to some debutante, you know, one-fourth his age. you know, smiling and chatting her up. So I have no doubt that Monty was suave and debonair, as you say. So yeah, there's this story that Ava Astor kind of dares him to go find the Ark of the Covenant. And at this point, he had been offered to lead the expedition. And he was kind of, she had a lot of suitors, and he didn't have the money or kind of the glory that most of them did. And I think it might have been a reason why he went, because he says, okay, I'm going to go get it and I'll be back to talk to you.
Yeah. You couldn't script this any better, could you?
No, I mean, people do a lot of grand things for love, and they do a lot of stupid things for love. And going after the Ark of the Covenant, to me, is kind of the ultimate mix of those two. So, yeah, you can't make it up.
Okay, take us to Jerusalem now with Monty Parker. Put us preferably underground in that same tunnel, if you can.
Yeah, so they get to the tunnel, and he has all kinds of people, you know, working for him. This British blue blood, ex-soldiers, in kind of into with tendrils into noble families, and they're out looking for the Ark of the Covenant, and they have no idea what they're doing because he comes and he doesn't bring an archaeologist, but somehow they make things happen. They start to look through some of the tunnels that Warren thought he saw but wasn't sure.
You're telling me that they are wealthy but rank amateurs.
Yeah, they don't know. They think they can do whatever they want. I think maybe is the best way to put it, because they have money and you know, some claims to titles and soldiers, been soldiers. But they've never been digging under Jerusalem before. So they're not, and they don't know anything about archaeology. So a lot of the stuff they do is by sheer force of will. So I'm not putting them down by saying that. I mean, that's the fact. They don't have degrees in archaeology or any experience. But somehow they start to make things happen. They start climbing and going to areas that no one could get to before. And all of a sudden they start clearing out this elaborate, what turns out to be a system of tunnels. And some parts are natural and some parts are clearly man-made. And all the while, you know, being pressed that we're getting closer to the Ark.
Who is Father Vincent in this story?
Father Vincent is this great character. He's a priest who is a local of Jerusalem, and he, unlike the Parker expedition, is an archaeologist, and he's been trained in it, and it's his passion, in addition to his priestly duties. And he finds out about the expedition, and he's just really interested. And, you know, one way or another, he gets hired on to it, because A, they don't have an archaeologist and they could really use one. But also to kind of get the locals off their backs, because they don't come in with signs and banners saying, you know, we're looking for the Ark of the Covenant. They keep that a complete secret. They actually tell the local government that, you know, we're going to dig around and we're going to build you a school, or we're going to build you a hospital, which is a complete lie. So they come in as kind of real scoundrels. But Father Vincent is not like that. He is obsessed with the scientific aspects of this tunnel. And he goes in and he has his measuring tape and his tools. And he is the one who finally marks everything off and measures out the entirety of Hezekiah's tunnel.
Is this like the first survey of the underground network?
Yes. And it's still used today. It's so good. People who go down there now, archaeologists, use his work. And it's fascinating to see him. He writes about it because he's a man of faith, a man of God. But he approaches this from a scientific basis. And to him, there's no problem. There are two separate things that coexist. And I think he's just this wonderful point of view in the whole story, where people are kind of, you know, fighting on those different sides. But he just looks at this as he can finally map this out, this important part of biblical history, and understand it a little better. And he has no idea, not that he says, it seems like they don't tell him about the ark. He may have known and just doesn't mention it, but he's there. He's the science part of it.
At some point in this story, I anticipate that they're not going to find the ark. Would that be a spoiler?
Well, I'm not going to say, because I wouldn't say that. I mean, I looked for it. I looked through Monty Parker's old catalog of things he had in his giant house. Was there a golden coffee table somewhere that maybe could be a prospect? So I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler, because, I mean, if I found the ark, I don't know that I would have written a book. Maybe I would have.
Well, look at that.
I'd be too scared.
Here's the thing. Too scared. I like that. If he had failed at this whole thing, then he wouldn't be bragging about it. But does he rise in the eyes of society in any way, shape, or form? Do people gather around him in greater numbers? I mean, you would think that a secret like that would get out and people would throng to his side.
Right. And he goes completely unnoticed. He comes up in 4 pages of a book maybe 10 years ago, where I first was introduced to him. Simon Sebag Montefiore's Jerusalem gives him a couple pages, but that's it until now. He's been totally forgotten, which means either he didn't find anything or he could keep a secret. And I'll back up on that spoiler a little bit, because I didn't find an actual ark, but I absolutely think he did find something.
Oh. Now, in radio, we have to pursue that line of questioning. That's our obligation. Okay, you mentioned earlier on some Phoenician inscriptions that were discovered when Warren was there. Spill a little. Tell us a little bit of what got found.
Well, part of what I wanted, I knew this book was going to be weird. At some point, I said, you know what? It's about the Ark of the Covenant, it's about people going after the Ark. Of course it's going to be weird. It has to be weird. And by weird, I mean kind of the old school meaning of the word, an element of the supernatural to it. And part of it to me, and part of why I wanted to write this book, is just seeing things and wondering if they have one meaning or another meaning, and whether they have a spiritual or a powerful meaning, or they have no meaning. Because I think there's a part of this book that's about kind of what we're going through these days with conspiracy theory. You know, it's so easy to fall into a story that is just a really good story because dots are connected. But there's a huge danger with that, because you lose the truth. But there's also, that's how a good story is made, by connecting the dots. So with the symbols that Warren's a long way of me saying, the symbols that Warren sees, he sees again, and he sees them in a place I never, ever thought I would ever write about, because I hate it as the subject. And I don't spoil too much about it, but he sees it when he later on in one of his, you know, zillion professions, he is the lead investigator of Jack the Ripper. He sees something that's very similar to it. And what does that mean? I don't know. But that's, to me, that is the kind of edging up on that spiritual experience, is when you see something and it can go both ways at once.
Yeah, you put me in the twilight zone here. Take me out of the twilight zone, put me into a into a museum, the Rockefeller Museum, because there is an artifact. Does it still exist today, this bowl?
Yes. So I think, you know, I was looking for anything that Monty found, and I found this great thing at the end, this great exchange of letters after the expedition was gone. And the ending of the expedition is this really, again, one of those you can't make it up, where they're disguising themselves, going into the Dome of the Rock, which is a immensely holy place for all the three religions in the area, and they disguise themselves and go in to dig. But after they leave, I found this great set of letters between these officials in Jerusalem that say, hey, we found this locked cabinet, and it says Parker Expedition on it. And they found it down in the village where they had dug, and they don't know who should open it, and there's all this bureaucracy, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. And they finally open it, and there's just and you think, I was reading this back and forth, I think this might be the Ark. They left it there because they knew they would be searched when they left. Their boats were searched by the Turks, so why not leave it there? And they finally get a hold of Mani, and he says, I don't want whatever's in there. He said, take it, it's yours. They finally open it, and it's a clay pot, which doesn't seem like much, but it's a clay pot that Father Vincent finds earlier. And it turns out to be the most historically significant find of the expedition, because it's really old and it has these Egyptian parts to it. And it's still in a museum today. And it's kind of the one thing left over from them. And it turns out it's not a supernatural thing, a box that you can speak with God. That might hold the remains of the Ten Commandments, but it's just a bowl that shows that people have been living in this area for 3,000 plus years. And there was something to me that really spoke to me about that, because I think Mani changes from being like a raider to, you know, to go back to our Indiana Jones, to someone at the end says, you know, you found this thing, it belongs in a museum. That there's still mystery in this empty bowl, you know, what was inside, who made it, who kept it. And that's, you know, that's not the Ark of the Covenant laying waste to Jericho. But to me, that's still pretty cool.
You know, I wonder if there's something in your own personal experience that, well, let me put it this way. I have stood in museums in front of objects behind glass walls and high security where these are ancient, ancient things, maybe climate controlled. Maybe it goes back to a time period of the Etruscans, or maybe it has its Egyptian artifacts or what have you. The King Tut's mask, I stood in front of that on one occasion in Los Angeles. Have you not had the experience of standing in front of something so old? It's one of the oldest objects you could ever encounter, and just kind of taking it in.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And that is a spiritual moment to me, because this bowl was made by people far older than even the Ark. And that's a wondrous thing. And yeah, I've been, the Rosetta Stone is what always does it to me whenever I see that in person. You know, here's two different people, two different, three really cultures talking to each other, you know, with an interpretive grid to translate a language. I mean, that's as good as it gets. That's it's interesting because we have these feelings and you see people at museums just standing in front of this stuff. I'm so glad you put it that way. It's kind of a spiritual thing because it's kind of a tie to an older humanity that, you know, we got through this. We're okay. We're doing this stuff. And there's something really special about that. The only thing I draw the line at is I do not feel that way when I see mummies. I can't stand mummies. but the mask of Tut would be something. I would love to see that someday.
Well, Brad Ricca, a pleasure to have you tell the tales here of Captain Charles Warren and Monty Parker and their expeditions. Great, great to learn about your book. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I had a great time.
Brad Ricca's book is titled True Raiders, The Untold Story of the 1909 Expedition to Find the Legendary Ark of the Covenant. Let's not leave biblical archaeology behind us just yet. You know that story of Jonah? Jonah, the one swallowed by a whale, some people say, or a big fish. We're going to tell that story and another story of that whale being swallowed by another whale or big fish and that one being swallowed by yet a third whale or big fish. Why three? What could that mean? Well, the story we're going to hear comes from a stunning ancient mosaic uncovered not that long ago in Galilee in a place called Hukok, an archaeological dig. We're going to speak with one of the researchers who found the mosaic. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Wasn't long ago I had the pleasure of visiting with Jody Magness, who is a classical and biblical archaeologist from the University of North Carolina. Jody Magness specializes in ancient Palestine, and she's director of an excavation project in Israel, the Hukok Excavation Project, and this involves an ancient, astonishing mosaic, which includes lots of biblical scenes, some of Samson, one particular of Jonah, and the story of Jonah and the whale becomes the story of Jonah and the whales, three of them. Very unusual depiction of the story.
It was one of your Brigham Young students who discovered our very first mosaic in the summer of 2012. Brian Bozung had just finished his bachelor's degree in economics, had never been on a dig, had never studied archaeology, but joined us that summer, and he was the one who found our very first mosaic.
What was that like? I mean, give me the blow-by-blow right there.
That was stunning because we had no idea that there were mosaics at this site. Usually, synagogues, the mosaics decorate the floor of a late Roman synagogue, meaning it dates to around a little after 400 AD. And usually synagogues of the particular type that we're excavating have flagstone floors rather than mosaics. So we were completely unprepared for this discovery.
Well, if he was so green at this, and you're there with, you know, you're the seasoned professional, what was your reaction, and how did you explain this?
Yeah, well, we kind of, before we hit the floor, we were digging through a lot of dirt. We sort of thought that there would be mosaics at some point. We didn't know where they were coming from because we were finding lots of little mosaic cubes that are called tesserae mixed in with the dirt. But we didn't really know that the floor was paved with mosaics till we hit it. And what happened was Brian was hoeing through the dirt and he felt his hoe clink on something and he got very excited and he called me over and I took a little paintbrush and brushed away the dirt and we could see the face of a woman in the mosaic floor peering out at us through the dirt.
And you said?
And, well, actually, everybody just came running at that point to look, and it was actually at that point we just shut the area down and called the site conservator to come because I'm not qualified to. Mosaics have to be uncovered in a very particular way. They need a lot of conservation. You can't just randomly uncover, you know, a 1,600-year-old mosaic. So we actually got on the phone with our site conservator, who wasn't with us at that point, and told her we had a mosaic emergency and she needed to come immediately. So she got there the next morning and uncovered the mosaic for us.
Yeah. I've never heard the phrase a mosaic emergency. We have a mosaic emergency. That's new to me.
Well, it was actually new for me, too.
When a picture first is brushed clean and you say, well, there's a human figure, well, there's an animal, well, there's a ship, there's a fish, whatever it is, when you first look at the image, do you even dare to interpret it or guess what it depicts?
Oh, yeah. Well, so we now actually do kind of play that game. You know, as the dirt is being brushed away, we all start trying to guess what it's going to be. And we don't award prizes, but we kind of feel like, you know, whoever guesses it right is the one who should win the prize. So the Samson and the Foxes was actually identified by an Israeli colleague of mine who was with us part of that summer, who has since passed away, David Amit, and he saw the foxes with the torches tied between their tails, and he immediately said, "Oh, that's Samson and the Foxes." And I'm like, "What's Samson and the Foxes?" That's not an episode that a lot of people necessarily pay attention to, but I have to say, I was the one who got right the parting of the Red Sea. I was the first one to get that one. So, you know, we kind of play that game now. You know, what is it that we're beginning to see as the dirt is being brushed away?
Yeah, well, these finds are just extraordinary. And we do want to talk about some of the images. You've mentioned Samson and the foxes. That's a biblical scene?
Yeah, nearly all of the mosaics decorating the floor are divided into panels. And the entire floor is covered with these panels. The overwhelming majority of them are biblical stories. And so we have two episodes of Samson and the Foxes, which is a story in the book of Judges 15, where Samson takes revenge on the Philistines by taking 300 foxes. He puts them in pairs. He ties their tails together, puts lighted torches between their tails, and sets them loose to burn down the agricultural fields of the Philistines. So that's one panel. And then the other Samson panel is from the book of Judges 16, which is Samson and the Gate of Gaza, where Samson goes to Gaza to sleep with a prostitute, and the people of Gaza decide they're going to ambush him when he comes out of the prostitute's house in the morning, but he fools them. He gets up at midnight, and he leaves the prostitute's house, and he pulls up the Gate of Gaza, puts it on his shoulders, and carries it away. So we have Samson carrying the Gate of Gaza on his shoulders. And then we have a series of biblical scenes that include Noah's Ark, and where you see all the pairs of animals, and we have the parting of the Red Sea, which is actually it's a little bit of a variant on the story of the parting of the Red Sea. It's Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed up by the Red Sea, but it's actually Pharaoh's soldiers being swallowed by giant fish in the Red Sea, which is an embellishment, of course, on the biblical story. And we have a depiction of the story of Jonah, which is the first time this story's ever been found decorating a synagogue, or it's actually the first time it's ever been found in ancient Jewish art. It was very popular among Christians in this period, but it's never been found in Jewish art. And it's also a variation on the story because it shows Jonah being swallowed by three successive fish instead of just one giant fish. And then we also have the building of the Tower of Babel, which is like a lesson in ancient building technology. It shows all the different kinds of building activities going on to build the tower. So those are pretty much the biblical scenes. We also have some panels that are biblical. There, say, a depiction of the spies carrying the bunch of grapes between a pole, which is in the book of Numbers. You know, they're sent to spy out the fertility of the land. We have a passage from Isaiah, which refers to the end of days, where, you know, all the different kinds of animals will make peace with each other, and the little child shall lead them, and that's what's shown. And we have three ewes in a row who we think, even though the inscription isn't preserved, we think are the three ewes in the furnace from the book of Daniel. So we have a wide variety of different biblical scenes. We also have a couple of mosaics that are not biblical, one which might be the legendary meeting between Alexander the Great and the Jewish high priest, although everybody who sees it has a different interpretation. That's my preferred interpretation. And we have a heliozodiac cycle in the middle of the synagogue, which is a motif that's been found now in 10 different ancient synagogues in Israel. There's a whole story behind that. Why, you know, why would you find that in the synagogue? But at any rate, it's not unique to our synagogue alone.
I want to go back to Jonah and the fishes. I'm just hoping against hope that whoever uncovered that first uncovered Jonah's feet and then uncovered the first fish and sequentially suddenly said, but there's another fish swallowing that fish. And then there's another. I don't know how that happened.
Actually, that wasn't quite the way it went, but at any rate, yeah.
Yeah. Let's get to this difference between the biblical scenes and the non-biblical scenes, because I understand that might be at the crux of what's so interesting here in challenging some of our previous assumptions.
Right. Well, our synagogue has a lot of features that are different from most other synagogues in Israel in this period. So we have over 120 known ancient synagogues in Israel until now. Not all of them necessarily completely excavated, but that we know of. And when I say ancient, that means Roman, Byzantine, so we're talking basically first century up to, let's say, early 7th century AD. And the majority of them date to around the same time as our synagogue does. So you know, our synagogue is distinguished in a number of ways from most of the other synagogues, even of the same type in this period in Israel. As I mentioned, it's different in having panels with figured scenes, mostly biblical, decorating the entire floor. So most synagogues in this period, if they have figured scenes decorating them in the mosaic floor, it's limited just to the central part of the hall, what we call the nave. But our synagogue has them also in the aisles, All of our inscriptions so far appear to be in Hebrew, which is unusual. You would think that's not unusual, but it is, because most of the inscriptions in this period in ancient synagogues are in Greek or Aramaic, and Hebrew is rather limited. And then we have this, as you point out, unusual non-biblical scene, what might be the meeting of Alexander the Great with the Jewish high priest, or might be a Maccabean scene. So having a scene in the synagogue that is not biblical is unusual. It's actually the very first time that an apparently non-biblical story has been found decorating an ancient synagogue. So there are other things, too, that are unusual. As I mentioned, we have these embellishments to biblical stories. There are a number of things that are unusual about our synagogue.
How large is this, and how much of it is preserved?
Right. The synagogue building is about 20 meters, a meter is about a yard, 20 meters long and 15 to 16 meters wide. And I would say we have about 70% of our mosaics preserved, which is actually pretty good. Not all of them are equally well preserved. The North Aisle, for example, is fairly damaged. But, there are substantial stretches of it that are very well preserved. By the way, let me point out that your listeners should not go running to visit Hukok. It's not open to the public. All the mosaics have been removed for conservation, and all the excavated areas have been backfilled. And once we're done our excavations, which will hopefully be within the next 4 to 5 years, we will then turn over the site to the Israeli government, and it will be up to them to decide if they want to develop it for tourism. And in the meantime, we will continue to work on publication and making the finds accessible to everyone. We have a website, which is just hukok.org, H-U-Q-O-Q.org, and everything that we've published is up there on links, and there are photos and media links and stuff like that, too.
Part of a conversation I had with Jody Magnus, an archaeologist from the University of North Carolina. She specializes in ancient Palestine. You've got to see the glorious mosaic photos. Easy to find. Just go to their website. Or you can just Google Hukok, H-U-Q-O-Q, and click on the images. They come right up. Beautiful, stunning images. From wonders beneath the earth to wonders up above, we have a space story for you next, an almost space story. 13 would-be astronauts, contenders to become among the very first NASA astronauts. 13 women. These are women who were far away from the spotlight for the most part, but they fought quietly and earnestly to become some of the first people in space. They put themselves through the very same rigorous testing the men were required to undergo, and in many instances performed even better than the men. That story next hour on Constant Wonder.